Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Hello, this is international Catholic singer Anna Nuzzo, inviting you to join me and Father Dan Cambra of the Marian Fathers on a select international tour's Divine Mercy pilgrimage to Poland and the Czech Republic. It takes place in September of 2019, and we would love for you to join us. For more information, go to my website, annanuzzo.com. Thank you, and God bless.
Looking for the perfect First Communion, Confirmation, or RCIA gift? Consider a beautiful, heirloom-quality, made-in-Italy rosary from Ghirelli. A Ghirelli rosary will be prayed with and cherished forever, guaranteed. Shop Ghirelli today. That's ghirelli.com.
Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and I'm super happy. We got 2 hours of great guests all rolled into one person. That's right. 2 hours of great guests all rolled into the person of Trent Horn. Trent Horn is an apologist here at Catholic Answers. He is a renowned speaker. He goes out and he debates people. He does things on the internet like podcasts, and he writes books as well. He does it all. It's Trent Horn. His latest book is Counterfeit Christ, Finding the Real Jesus Among the Imposters. And we're going to spend some time with Trent today talking about the church and the world. And I am super fired up for it. Hello, Trent.
Hello, Cy. I'm excited to be here with you.
I'm glad you are. I'm glad you are, because I think some people have the impression that you and I don't get along. And it comes, I think, from the fact that I tell people that I don't like you. Mm-hmm. I probably should stop doing that, because some people think that's serious.
I think the only reason you say that, Cy, is because deep down you want to be popular, and there's lots of people who don't like me. But you don't have to worry about what those people think. Don't try to jump on the bandwagon.
I see what you're
with
saying.
Them.
Yeah. I'm just trying to be in with the other kids.
You want to be with the cool kids.
Yeah, who also don't like you.
Yeah.
Like celebrities.
Yeah.
Well, I bet there are some celebrities who love you, though. I'm going to try to think of a celebrity right now who loves you. I would bet – no, he just passed away. He hasn't been a celebrity for about a decade. I got nothing, Trent.
Well, I would
you
say –
you are hated by celebrities.
No, I would say my wife loves me, and she is a celebrity both in our house, and I think many people may have recognized her. She was the stunt double for Reese Witherspoon in Legally Blonde, so –
That's not true.
No, but it's a compliment for my wife, and I'm allowed to stretch the truth a bit to put it on radio.
I think that's a compliment for Reese Witherspoon.
It does go both ways.
What? I'm now more popular with your wife than you are, Trent Horn. All right, we're going to talk about the church in the news today.
I'm just kidding. let's talk.
The church in the news, the church in the world, there's so much to talk about. People are welcome to call in and participate in our conversation today. We like to do this on Fridays sometimes. Take some time to take stock of where the church is in the world. 888-31-TRUTH is the number. Oh, by the way, I mentioned Trent's book, Counterfeit Christs, Finding the Real Jesus Among the Imposters, and it's really good, and you should get it. It's from Catholic Answers Press. It's out now. And it's one of those – Trent did it again. He came up with this clever idea of one way to lead people to the true Christ is to point out all the fake Christs that are out there. It's very clever and brilliant. And okay, Trent, here's the deal. You're also – before you were even a Catholic apologist, you were giving everything you had to, and living, on Top Ramen, as far as I think, and I don't think I'm exaggerating, as a pro-life person?
It was bulk microwavable burritos.
Oh yeah, bulk microwave, which are very expensive now.
Now they are.
Deal, but yeah. Okay. So I want to get your view of what's happening in the pro-life movement right now. If you just look at it from how upset the people are on National Public Radio and other places, you would think that pro-life people are winning. Would you share that?
There are a lot of big things happening.
Okay.
And I think it's important. I always try to be very balanced in my presentations with things.
Yeah.
And not, I always try to not overstate my case, whether it's in my books or other things that I care about. And that's also kind of a personal philosophy and way that I approach life. I guess I always have a lot of lowered expectations. So I think it's better to be pleasantly surprised every now and then constantly disappointed. So I'm not a wild-eyed optimist.
No, good. All right.
And so instead, I set my expectations low and then usually, oh, wow, things weren't as bad as I thought they would be. So when it comes to what's happening in pro-life legislation now, we have the Georgia heartbeat bill that's been passed. The Alabama governor signed their abortion ban into law. And I think Missouri actually just signed
today, I think,
an abortion ban. I say, good. God bless them. We have been locked in a stalemate for nearly 50 years now on the issue of abortion. When it comes to Roe versus Wade, that the Supreme Court handed down Roe, striking down any relevant or meaningful legal protections for unborn children, essentially making abortion legal through all 9 months of pregnancy for virtually any reason. And so this prevented states from reaching, this really stalled back in 1973, the democratic debate and discussion the nation was having about the issue of abortion, that there were some states that made abortion legal, even in a wide range, like California, New York, Colorado, Hawaii. And then you had many other states that that granted legal protection for the unborn or allowed exceptions in rape or incest. You had people coming to conclusions, and then the court steps in and really disrupted this. So what is interesting is that in nearly 50 years, public opinion on abortion has not changed very much. We don't see this with very many other social issues. I mean, you look, for example, at public approval of homosexual behavior or even other kinds of social issues that are brought forward, or tolerance for divorce or premarital sex. In 50 years, a lot of public opinion has shifted on those issues.
Yeah.
This is really locked in. So I would be grateful at the very least remember that if the Supreme Court overturns Roe versus Wade, that's not the end of the pro-life battle. It's the beginning of 50 new ones.
Now, what do you make of the argument I want to throw two at you. One, I read today in The Federalist, David Harsanyi, I believe is how you pronounce his name, a fine writer and does a great job, but he's very pro-life, but he says this Alabama bill is unwise because it makes the political advancement of the pro-life cause more difficult, and it's likely to be thrown out by the Supreme Court. What do you make of that argument?
Yeah, and I've heard this.
I kind of paraphrased the argument. I didn't do a very good job. But
no, I see what is happening here, and I actually quoted a little bit of Martin Luther King Jr. on my social media today with my thoughts on it. Of course, with 140 characters, you can't add a lot of nuance. I don't have an animus towards really feelings of ill will towards pro-lifers who are genuinely concerned that we may be moving too fast and moving these bills forward. Their ultimate concern, I think, is this. These bills are going to go forward. They will be struck down by federal courts. But then the goal, of course, is to get to the Supreme Court. And they're concerned it'll be struck down by the Supreme Court and the right to abortion will be cemented even more. And then on top of that, because I know the Tennessee bishops, for example, came out, along with Tennessee Right to Life, came out against a Tennessee heartbeat bill. Said the bishops, although ironically, the bishops also came out a day or two ago again, appealing to the governor to not execute a Tennessee death row inmate. So it's just like, nobody's saying, nobody's saying there like, oh, no, what if there's a backlash from the governor?
But what do you make of the Tennessee bishop's argument? Are they saying, is it a political argument, basically? Like, let's do this right
an argument from prudence saying, look, the idea from the other side, pro-lifers to say we shouldn't move forward is if we move forward, we're going to lose and it's going to do more harm than good. And we're going to have to pay pro-choice lawyers and Planned Parenthood and the ACLU a ton of money. They're going to win in these cases. So let's not do that. Let's just move forward incrementally. And I am sympathetic to that argument, but at the same time, I would rather just go for it because I don't see, I don't know in the near future or the long future when there will be an ideal time to give it a try. People, it's always dangerous to say, well, here's what we think the Supreme Court's going to do. It's like, it's like you got
done that before.
It's like, well, it's like ESPN Sports Center. People are getting around like, well, we've looked at, you know, Kavanaugh's new here on the bench and we know what Roberts is going to do. And then someone chimes in like, he's going to, you know, double back on, that's just terrible. That's terrible if he's not going to uphold that. And then Charles Barkley gets in here and we're, you know, we're just.
I do not say anything bad about Charles Barkley.
I don't say anything bad. I love Charles Barkley.
All right.
So I just, and I think it's terrible when people make fun of him.
The great Charles Barkley, I call him. And that's coming from a Celtic fan, too.
Okay.
So he really is great if a Celtic fan likes him.
There you go. So the concern here is I don't like that trying to say, well, let's not go to the Supreme Court until we know how they're going to rule. Because they're people. They're nine individuals. We don't. It's hard to know. Some were, you know, you've had people who are appointed and have made, even both the liberal and the conservative justices have made decisions that have surprised people.
Right.
So
take the shot, you're saying.
Yeah, I lean in that direction. I'm not super strong. I'm not, and so like I said, people who disagree with me, I totally see where they're coming from, and I see all the different arguments, but I think the arguments and my gut feeling move me personally towards saying, I say we go for it. So in fact, two of my favorite pro-life writers disagree on this subject.
Really?
You can see them in the National Review. Ramesh Ponnaru, who... He wrote a great... Well, he wrote a great book called The Party of Death, about, you know, which political party is really in favor of things like abortion. I'll give you a guess. It's 50-50, but you won't need it. So he wrote that book. But he came out saying, well, he's saying for the incremental approach. Like, maybe we shouldn't go for broke right now. But another writer I really like, David French in the National Review, is saying, this is the time. Let's go for it. And if we get struck down, that just shows the federal solution isn't our option and we will give up the federal option and we'll go for more local incremental approaches. And we have made a lot of gains incrementally. Abortions are now down from a high of 1.2 million in the early 90s to less than a million a year. You know, it's a 20% reduction, hundreds of thousands of lives. Now, there's a multitude of factors that play into that, some being the work of pro-life advocates who have shut down abortion facilities, have enacted local restrictions.
Right.
And other things are just changes in culture, ironic changes in culture. For example, the growing alienation we have from one another through things like social media has led to an all-time low in teenage sexual activity.
Which is definitely going to give you fewer babies.
It will.
Those two things are connected. I looked it up.
But you see, actually, we are now, the birth rate is down to, I think, in the U.S. to about 1.8, which is below replacement levels.
Yeah, that's not good news.
But
I see what you're saying.
Right. But. We're at a very low birth rate for women under the age of 35, but it actually has increased a little bit from like 35 to 45, because people are
Can I give you the other argument that I've been hearing?
Yes. Yes, you may.
Okay. So the other argument is, well... and this is a political argument too. The truth is, they're never going to overturn Roe v. Wade because Republicans want the issue. They want to just keep whipping up their base with this issue.
Now, that's an argument that I can't side with because it ascribes nefarious motives to individuals, and I would ask for a charge that grave to have evidence for that.
Plus, it counters what you said earlier, which is the truth, and any political person would know this. If Roe v. Wade is overturned, it becomes the biggest political battle ever in every single state, 50 states.
Right, that argument undercuts itself because now if Roe versus Wade is overturned, if you have, you know, Republican pro-life advocates, I mean, we have at least some Democrat pro-lifers, not very many. You have more pro-choice advocates in the Republican Party than you have pro-lifers in the Democrat Party, which is sad. So you're right that if Roe is overturned, people accuse the Republican Party of saying, well, you're using this issue as a hook for people, so you don't want it to be overturned. Even if people had those nefarious motives, if you overturn Roe, now suddenly all of these state House representatives, state senators, these politicians who identify as pro-life, and people think, well, I don't care if my local omnibus, you know, comptroller or whatever is pro-life. It doesn't matter. All that matters is the Supreme Court. That will greatly change. If Roe is overturned, that will really change the dynamics of local and state elections to show that a candidate's position on life will really hold a lot more teeth now because they're capable of enacting actual meaningful change.
It'll actually matter.
And people can be held accountable if they don't, if they're not willing to usher that in. So Yeah. We have to pray. We have to understand at the end of the day, remember what the Psalms, the psalmist says, put not your trust in princes, that we cannot be delivered from evil ultimately by man because evil springs from the heart of man. But God will deliver us from evil, and we should trust in him and pray and ask for him to have mercy on our nation and mercy on ourselves for the times when we have failed, when we have done evil and we have failed to do good.
Would you agree with me if I said to you, since Roe was decided, the primary public obvious opponent to this abortion regime has been the Catholic Church?
It was the first. I would say that since Roe versus Wade in 1973, the law, and even historians, other Protestants, people will agree, when Roe versus Wade was handed down in 1973, it really was the Catholic Church that was opposed to it. That the Catholic Church helped to create the National Right to Life movement. Essentially, was an outgrowth of the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Even in the 70s and early 80s, the Southern Baptists, for example, they had platforms that were in favor of abortion.
Yeah.
Not very many Protestants and evangelicals were on board, at least in the 70s and the early 80s. It wasn't until the moral revolution in the moral majority in the late 80s and early 90s, where evangelicals took this on as something that is important to them because there's lots of different reasons why, but I think part of it is for many Protestants, because scripture does not contain an explicit condemnation of abortion, it gives them significant wiggle room.
Yeah.
Whereas in the 70s,
they got it right, man. Right. Once they got it right, they got it right.
And for example, on Sunday, I'm hoping to go visit some of my pro-life advocate friends up in Los Angeles. They're holding a training there for an outreach at University of California in LA, and they're half Protestant, half Catholic, and they're some of the finest people I know who are out there on the front lines. Sorry.
You mean half of the people are Protestant and half are Catholic, not their each person is half Catholic.
Right. They're not some kind of religion. They're not a religious centaur.
Very confusing
or a minotaur.
The way you said that. I'm going to go hang out with a bunch of people who are half Catholic, half Protestant. Hey, I got to send you off to, we're going to take a break. Trent Horn is our guest. Church in the World is our topic for 2 hours today. We got a whole bunch more to talk about. If you got something you want to talk to us about, what we just discussed, the abortion issue, and it's how it is making progress these days, you're welcome to call 888-31-TRUTH. But we got more issues to cover too. We got a whole bunch of things to get to, some fun, some very grave, but we'll try to do our best on all of them. I've mentioned Christ's book, Counterfeit Christ, Finding the Real Jesus Among the Imposters. It's on sale just like every other book. It's a brand new baby book, but it's on sale even as it makes its way into the world now, because we have this 15% off at shop.catholic.com. If you put in the promo code SPRING19 for the next 12 days at shop.catholic.com, you get 15% off your whole order.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Encounter with Dan Demattei and Patrick Rice is our new radio show for young adults.
The Holy Spirit is about a new and exciting work in the young church of today. On Encounter, we bring young adults the life-changing testimonies of ordinary people that launch them into lives of extraordinary mission. Their testimonies bring faith and power into the lives of everyone who listens.
Encounter with Dan Demattei and Patrick Rice. The spiritual awakening continues Saturday night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Trent Horn is our guest both hours today. We're kind of doing a review of the church in the world right now, trying to take a hard look at the situation around the world. And we start with abortion because the state of opposition to abortion wouldn't be anywhere near what it is today around the world had it not been for the leadership of the Catholic Church in the very beginning and ongoing. I always like to remind people that the day after the Roe versus Wade decision came down, the New York Times had a giant headline about it and a big news story. And the story right next to it was the reaction from the Catholic bishops, because even the New York Times knew There's only two sides to this, the court and the U.S. bishops. So that's part of why we, and we're obviously pro-life people. And so we include that in this Church in the World episode that we're doing today. We have a bunch of callers that want to talk to you about things. Trent, shall we?
Yeah, sure.
All right, let's start with Elena in Baltimore, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Thanks for joining us from Baltimore. Elena, your question or comment for Trent.
Yes, hi. I want to know that, well, my son sent me a picture, and he's saying that people are questioning that conservatives who believe in abortion, who believe in a ban on abortions, and if you have like a 12-year-old girl who's raped and she's pregnant, how do you force the little girl to keep a baby after she's already been beaten and abused and her life has been stolen from her, and now she has to host this baby? Now they're calling them a host.
Yep, that's a very fair question, actually. There's nothing unfair about it, and we're happy to address it.
Sure. Elena, I think that when you address this question of what about a victim of rape, especially a minor who is a victim of rape and is pregnant, shouldn't they be allowed to have an abortion? You have to gauge the kind of person that you're dealing with. There's going to be different kinds of people that raise this argument. Some people are genuine seekers. They're torn. They realize abortion is wrong, or they don't like abortion, but they think abortion might be okay in this case. And here we need to walk them through the moral logic. First, by affirming that rape is a terrible thing, and affirming especially that what makes rape wrong are the numerous instances of injustices it does to women, not just the attack itself, but when people refuse to believe women, even when there's good evidence that they've been a victim of rape, when people blame women for attacks on them, when they should never be blamed, it's never their fault for what's happened to them. And to say that, you know, in other countries, there are people who, practice honor killings. In other countries, there's places where a victim of rape is executed. That's horrifying. So you could have common ground to say, we agree that a victim of rape should not be executed for being raped. That's barbaric. But then you can bring it over to say, even in this country, we don't execute the rapist. That's also barbaric. But why would we execute the child? That doesn't make sense. Now, if the concern is about the person, either the woman or the girl who has been raped and the trauma she's endured, you can say, well, obviously, yes, it's horrible. If we could take that trauma away, we would. But nothing can make someone unraped. The question is, do we want to add more trauma onto that trauma? Do we want to take a victim of violence and make them an accomplice to more violence so that they know that thinking on even 10, 20, 30 years later, they participated in the death of their unborn child? I would never want to saddle that upon any woman of any age to endure that kind of trauma. And I've heard that firsthand from women who are post-abortive. So that's how I would recommend with people who, you know, they're struggling. Other people are crusaders. They throw this hard case out there because, honestly, they want abortion to be legal in all cases. And they want to use this hard case to obscure the issue. I call it a smokescreen. So you can expose the smokescreen by saying, especially with a contentious person, I tell you what, let's play make a deal. If I agree that abortion should be legal in the case of rape, do you think it should be illegal in all the other cases? Most people are going to say, no, of course not. It should be legal for women. Then you'll say, well, why did you bring this up in the first place? Rape isn't the issue you're concerned about. You want abortion to be legal. Why? Let's talk about that. So those are the two different routes I might go with in a discussion like that. Is that helpful for you?
Yes, that helps a lot. And then I also wanted to say I'm originally from San Diego, and I moved out here about 6 years ago or 16 years ago.
Oh, very good.
Well, we miss you. Oh, this is the Elena from San Diego.
Well, of course.
Nothing's been the same since you left, but Baltimore's lucky to have you.
Hope you're enjoying Elena. Baltimore and the East Coast. Thank you.
Thanks very much for starting us off with that call, Elena. Let us go to Abraham in San Antonio, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Abraham, your question or comment for Trent?
Yeah, hey, Trent. I just had a comment. On the abortion, of course, I just think that basically right now, because everywhere you go, CNN, Yahoo News, Internet, everybody, you see nothing but things that are against the abortion, that the people are mad because of this, mad because of that. And the,
you mean they're mad about these? Hold on, Abraham. You mean they're mad about these laws that are banning abortion? I can't imagine Yahoo and CNN are mad about abortion.
I mean, about like the three states, the ones
right.
that are
they're yeah. mad about laws that would restore the right to life unborn children once had, though they wouldn't put it that way.
Yeah, exactly.
Though they wouldn't put
and,
it that way.
Right. So I just wanted to realize that, you know, there's I mean, if you think about it, a lot of news places, the ones that are for abortion, they're the ones that are going and putting all these things up. And you really don't see a lot of the ones that are for pro-life. So I just want to make a comment on that, just basically that a lot of the broadcast that you're seeing right now, they're all mad because of what happened, what's happening in Missouri and Alabama. And I think there was another state that they're starting to, you know, go against the abortion laws.
Yeah. Abraham, is it your – if I may ask you real quick, Abraham, so is it your impression that the news media tends to be more in favor of abortion than opposed to it?
Definitely, yes. Everywhere that I see, I've been looking at the internet, and that's all you see is just that. Everybody's mad. Even Captain America, I saw there was an article that he was going and making a comment on you know, what happened, I think, with the law that happened against Alabama.
Well, no, celebrities are notorious for their deep thinking and important moral contributions, but I will leave that there and turn it over to Trent for your response. Sorry, I was a smart aleck. Are you shocked to hear this? The media tends to be pro-choice?
No, I'm not shocked about that at all, that when you do informal polls, when you look at the leanings of people in institutions of power in the United States, in academia, universities, among journalists, in Hollywood, almost overwhelmingly support legal abortion. And you look at the movie Unplanned, which dramatizes the real-life story of Abby Johnson, who was one of the higher-ups in Planned Parenthood who left to become pro-life, that the makers of Unplanned had a very difficult time in Hollywood making their film. They couldn't secure basic rights to music, even, because what they were doing was quote-unquote controversial. Though I think pro-choice Hollywood filmmakers don't run into those kind of barriers.
Which strikes me, Trent, as it's really good news when you say that the attitude on abortion hasn't changed, because in every way the media has tried to budget and people know, no, this is wrong.
No.
We'll be right back with more Church in the World with Trent Horn.
Catholic Answers Live.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
In his new audio presentation, The Very First Fathers, apologist Jimmy Akin takes you on a tour of the earliest Christian writings outside the New Testament, from the most famous figures and most notable works to those lesser known but no less important. This pivotal time in the development of the early church is revealed in fascinating detail. Jimmy shows how, even in the first century after the resurrection, it was necessary to defend and explain truths that are still under attack today, such as the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist and the perpetual virginity of Mary. The Very First Fathers is a compelling look at the dawn of the Christian age and edifying listening for anyone who wants to understand and defend the full truth of Catholicism. Order your copy of The Very First Fathers today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew that she wanted those things, that in them somehow she would find God. Over the years as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Trent Horn is our guest today. Despite, I don't know how these rumors get started, but I love it when Trent is here. I don't know why people, all right, I know why, because I'm always teasing Trent. But I tease you. Do you know that I really enjoy doing the show with you?
Are you aware of that? I am aware.
Does my teasing bother you? Because I could stop.
No, that's okay. Really? I have a long history of enduring it, so
do you?
Gives me a leather, metaphorically leathery hide for the stuff.
You see, I'm also, this might be an affliction. I hadn't thought about this, but I'm the oldest of four brothers, and so teasing your younger brothers is like it's a bad habit that you develop from very early.
I can understand. I'm the oldest of three, so. Maybe we're just in competition for dominance here. Who can be the oldest of the oldest?
Well, if it goes on brain power, Trent, I'm going to lose. But maybe we could just go on, like, I don't know, something else. Trent.
Age. I guess you would be. Maybe you'd be barely a bit. You'd be the oldest of the oldest here.
I could be the silverback. Or the silver beard anyways. Okay, look, Trent. Yeah. I am actually kind of sad about something because sure. I read in the Atlantic today, an article from, a well-known
you can mention who it
Catholic,
is. That's fine.
Yeah, no, I'm going to mention it. But who a former priest who some would call a dissenting Catholic. He would certainly not call himself a dissenting Catholic, but he's been fussing and complaining about the Catholic Church.
Well, if it walks like a duck and doesn't want to go to mass like a duck, you know, what kind
of... Yeah, but I feel bad for him. But maybe my sympathies are misplaced, but a very articulate writer, James Carroll, they wrote a column for the Boston Globe for years. Yeah. He doesn't like the hierarchy. He doesn't like the moral teachings of the church in many cases. He doesn't like the way he certainly doesn't like clericalism, and I'm with him on that. We shouldn't be a clericalist church, but...
Doesn't like a lot of things related to the Catholic faith.
But he calls himself I'm from the Vatican II generation. His hero is Pope John the 23rd. Mm-hmm. And God bless him. He's a saint, Pope John the 23rd, great hero. But I think he misunderstands the Pope and has misappropriated some of the spirit of the Second Vatican Council. So he says, and this is a big, big article in the Atlantic.
It's very long. I only could...
Well, it's like he rehashes every complaint he's made over the last 50 years about the Catholic Church. But this is the part that makes me sad, is he does say he's suffering oceans of grief over the abuse scandals and all that. And I do believe him. I think he is suffering oceans of grief over it. And he says the way that he has dealt with it is he has stopped going to Mass and he's not going to receive the Eucharist anymore.
Very sad. That's very sad.
What do you think about it?
This article he wrote in the Atlantic that was just published, it's from their June print edition, but it's being published online now. It's called "To Save the Church, Dismantle the Priesthood" by James Carroll.
Yeah.
And so he just lays the blame. His argument is basically, look at these bad priests and look at the temptation for priests to be treated as infallible figures to not be questioned, who live double lives and lives of secrecy, that the best way to stop the best way to save the church from the abuse crisis is to get rid of the priesthood. Now that's that's like saying the best way to get rid of child abuse by parents is to send every kid to an orphanage. It's like, well, yeah, that will solve that problem, but you create an even larger problem. For example, if you send kids to orphanages, they're probably going to end up being abused way more. I mean, you know, that's what's going to happen in these kinds of situations. Much the same way, you get rid of the priesthood, what are you going to have? In his article, when I was going through the article, this was one part, Si, that really stuck out to me that I thought was absurdly ignorant. I don't know what I couldn't. So here's the part.
It's kind of a willful blindness in James Carroll's. It's awful.
Here's what he says.
What he's allowed himself to stoop to. But go ahead.
Clericalism's origins lie not in the Gospels, but in the attitudes and organizational charts of the late Roman Empire. Now, first, if he's concerned about clericalism, the idea of having, you know, the bad kind of clericalism where, you know, there's secrecy. You could even, I mean, I'm not saying obviously Jesus and the apostles did not practice clericalism, but Jesus gave the apostles unique authority over other people. He even told them to keep his messianic identity a secret.
Right.
So you know, so the idea here is, well, we don't see, you know, you don't, obviously, I'm saying,
no, it's a fantasy of the early church is what it is.
Yeah. And so later on, it's from the Roman Empire creating this hierarchical structure. That's the problem for him.
Right.
So obviously, Jesus and the apostles did not practice clericalism. They practice hierarchy, a sacred order. So he says, Christianity was very different at the beginning. The first reference to the Jesus movement in a non-biblical source comes from the Jewish Roman historian Flavius Josephus, writing around the same time that the Gospels were taking form. Josephus described the followers of Jesus simply as those that loved him at the first and did not let go of their affection for him. There was no priesthood yet, and the movement was egalitarian. But that is an absurd conclusion to draw from one line in Josephus's book, The Antiquities of the Jews, when he speaks about, in book 18, he says, at this time there was a man named Jesus. He goes on a short little discursus. He's talking about the life in Judea during the reign of the procurator Pontius Pilate. And he says, yeah, there was this Jesus. He was a wise man. He won over many Jews and Greeks, but he was brought up on charges by the leading men among us and was crucified. Those that followed him did not, you know, they did not abandon him. But from that one line, you can't get from Josephus, who is an outsider, that he's making an all-encompassing description of the Christian movement that it had no priests or no hierarchy.
No. What were the apostles?
He's simply saying, I could say the same thing, that the first Christians who loved Jesus did not abandon him. It doesn't follow from that they didn't have important roles in the church or that there wasn't a sacred hierarchy from that one description. So, you know, Josephus is writing around 93 AD. We're saying, okay, well, we're taking a non-biblical source. What about so the antiquities? We're getting that around late 90s, first century.
Okay.
You go to 106 AD, second century, just 10 years later, you have the writings of St. Ignatius of Antioch, who very clearly says, here's what St. Ignatius says in his letter to the Smyrnians. He says, see that you all follow the bishop, even as Jesus Christ does the Father, and the presbytery as you would the apostles, and reverence the deacons as being the institution of God. Let no man do anything connected with the church without the bishop. So he goes on to talk about how the Eucharist should be celebrated with the bishop. But that's completely opposed to what Carroll wants in this art. He basically wants the church to become a Protestant congregational service.
Well, I was going to read you what he wants the church
go
to
ahead.
Become and
yeah.
let you
yes.
comment on
go,
it because
go right
it's
ahead.
Really striking.
And I love,
what he
though, the gall he has to say the early church was like this.
Yeah.
When we have evidence also from the New Testament about the role of the presbyterate, the priests, the episcopoi, those who oversaw it, that the apostles were people who had authority, delegated authority to others.
And he knows better. That's what I mean by a willful
blindness.
It comes out of a broken heart. I really do believe that.
It's hard. What I think he might try to say is that, well, we can't read this into the Gospels. We can't trust this in the Gospels. We can't trust Ignatius. We can only trust, you know, what this one line in Josephus that's been radically reinterpreted.
Yeah.
But when you look at the evidence, he's just wrong on that one point. I read the article.
Right,
I was thinking, what's his solution?
Okay, so he gives you that false impression of the early church that had no priesthood. And then this is his vision of the future. And this is where he leaves us with his vision of the future. The church I foresee will be governed by lay people, although the verb govern may apply less than serve. There will be leaders who gather communities in worship, and because the tradition is rich, striking chords deep in human history, such sacramental enablers may well be known as priests. They will include women and married people. They will be ontologically equal to everyone else. They will not owe fealty to a feudal superior. Catholic schools and universities will continue to submit to the faith. Continue to is kind of a strong word there, and vice versa. Catholic hospitals will continue. He goes on and on and on, but you get the idea. He wants us to go back to house churches, but he even wants the house churches to have no priests. Just whoever gets up and starts blessing the bread, that's fine with him. I don't see how this is any different than Protestantism.
It's not. It's Protestants playing with obs and vespers and trying to keep that veneer. They want to maintain a Catholic veneer because it is comfortable and familiar, but not have anything that makes Catholicism great. That the church is the hierarchy of the church has, that clericalism seeps in and causes bad things, but at the same time, it ensures things like doctrinal unity.
Yeah.
If you don't have that, here's what's going to happen if you get this. Let's say we didn't have the bishops and the priests. They all got Thanos'd, you know, and we just had the laity. What are we going to, you know, obviously this is an impossible counterfactual. But what would happen is he's assuming that we would all peacefully meet in our house churches and hold to his same, the Carolite yeah. school that believes contraception is okay.
I know.
I'm sure he's probably all right with abortion.
Yes, all of this.
But what right. about if I had to start my house church, I'd say, well, we're going to hold to the teachings of the church that have been handed down for 2,000 years.
Then it'd be endless fighting.
You'd
probably get like 30,000 different denominations yeah. or something.
Now, that number is grossly inflated. We'll have to save that for another show. But you would... You would have division and discord, or you have what you have with the Methodist Church.
Right.
The Methodist Church of America, United Methodist, is going through a radical split right now. They're divided down the middle about whether they should embrace homosexual behavior as something to be celebrated or whether it's sinful.
But whatever his vision is, it's wrong to say the Catholic Church has disappointed me, therefore I look forward to a Catholic Church that's made in my image.
And
that's so sad.
Here's what's sad. We should pray for James Carroll and for anyone who's become disillusioned with the faith, that I understand the pain and I understand that they're hurting. And I understand being angry if you've seen priests and bishops drop the ball royally when it comes to doing the right thing.
Yeah,
I get that. But it doesn't – the problem is that is not a Catholic problem. That is a sin problem. You enact these solutions, you're still – the same problems are going to show up. I actually have an article at Catholic.com called "Is Sex Abuse a Catholic Problem?" On Catholic Answers Magazine online. And I reference in there a 2018 study by three criminologists that show that hundreds of claims of sexual abuse are made every year against Protestant pastors, many of whom are married.
Yeah. So, or against public school teachers. We bury that. We act like it doesn't happen, but it's all around
us. I remember reading, I think it was Monica Applegate, who's been studying sex abuse for a long time, saying the problem in public schools could be 100 times worse.
Yeah.
Than what you see in the Catholic Church. But the problem is, it goes back to cultural elites, journalists, academics, who have an axe to grind against the church, and now they've got a weapon
yeah.
to get in there,
right.
Where they won't... You look anywhere else. It's so funny. When you see other people... I love seeing people in Hollywood and feminists who rail against the church for sex abuse. But when it is discovered in their own ranks, they circle the wagons.
Yeah.
Roman Polanski's a great director. there was a feminist academic, a female feminist academic, who was accused of sexual harassment, who was one of the leaders in the Me Too movement, and her colleagues have rallied around her saying these charges are overblown and they're not a big deal.
Right. And we have to be careful that we don't do that as Catholics.
But that's the thing. We do that. Yeah.
Yeah. We got to knock that off
there's a fallacy too quoque.
Yeah,
that's saying what I'm doing isn't wrong because you do the same thing. That's a fallacy.
Yes.
The truth is we're all guilty of sin. We've all got it in this together. The solution is not to torpedo the primary means God gave us to get out of this sinful mess that we are in.
Right.
That is what we want to draw people to. That, you know what? You want to go down this path. You want to start your Protestant or your secular organization. Sin still lives in the hearts of men.
You're not going to make things better.
You see, every other week, I feel like there's a male feminist on YouTube or the internet who gets outed for sexual abuse. That this is endemic to the human condition. And I would recommend my article, "Is Sex Abuse a Catholic Problem?"
Well, one of the things about being old, being my age, Trent, is that I remember, because I was there in the early 1980s in Catholic universities, when there was this sense of tremendous disappointment in many of the theology faculties that Pope John Paul was the Pope,
yeah.
and that he was
yeah.
his view of the Second Vatican Council was triumphing, and you remember Charles Curran and all those guys, and then
yes.
and James Carroll was one of the people cheerleading against Pope John Paul.
Well, he was ordained in 1969. I think he left the priesthood about 5 or 6 years later,
yeah, right.
And he left. I think he got married shortly thereafter and wanted to become an author. And this was not the vocation that he was called to. And this was also a very difficult time in the church's history. But it makes me think also there's another news item when you think about priests who have left the priesthood, understanding how to have a strong priesthood, that I saw online that Father Jonathan Morris, a former member of the Legion of Christ, he's a Catholic priest, he's on Fox News all the time. He's announced he's sought permission from Pope Francis to leave the priesthood.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, you know, human beings are human beings. Stuff's going to happen.
Yeah.
But if you get into your old age and you're still bitter about battles that were fought 50 years ago, you come on.
But you know what? To compare Father James Carroll
and
Father Morris, actually, the differences between the two, there's an article in Catholic Culture a few years back about James Carroll Strikes at the Church Again by Phil Lawler. And there, Carroll was criticizing the church because of canonizations, and specifically saying that the church should not use miracles as a criteria because it's offensive to say that God would miraculously heal one person but not another.
I know that's it's there's a
so here's the thing. I want to make that point, because when people read others and read authors who say I'm fed up with X in the church, clericalism, sex abuse, which you rightfully have to be fed up.
Right.
A lot of times it is a Trojan horse for
what
other radical commitments. I'm fed up with sex abuse,
well
clericalism,
put.
And the supernatural.
Very
wait,
well.
Wait, what? What was the last one there?
Clericalism.
You
wait, huh? What? Well, yeah, God offends me is what it comes down to.
Right. It's, yeah. And so, so the first paragraph makes an analogy that Carroll continues to gripe about the church, that Lawler makes the analogy of the guy who continues to post embarrassing photos of his ex-girlfriend on the internet to keep that he's already broken up with to, you know, out of that there's a lot of anger and bitterness here and wanting the church to really be Catholic in name only. Now, Father Morris has sought to leave to be laicized. There is no term in canon law called laicization.
Yeah.
Because a priest is always a priest.
The old term in canon law was reduced to the lay state, but they also don't say that anymore.
No, because you're not a lay person, but you are dismissed from the clerical state.
Yeah.
So Father Morris is saying he wants to seek out a married life and a married vocation. He has said it's not because he has an existing relationship. So I'm taking him at his word that that's the case, that he thinks he would be happier. And so he sought, and the church has the authority to do this. I want to check to correct this, because some people have approached me on social media saying, how can a priest do this? Isn't he breaking his vows? How can he be in good standing? Well, the church has the authority that, you know, a priest is not married to the church in the same way I'm married to my spouse, where it's indissoluble, provided that it's a valid sacramental marriage. A priest is under the juridical authority of the church. And so the church has the authority to bind him or to loose, to free him from being under that authority. He can be, if he requests it, to be dismissed from the clerical state. He still has obligations as a priest. So, for example, if he's at an accident scene and somebody says, I need to go to confession, I'm worried I might die.
He's got to
do it, because he's once a priest, always a priest. He still has those obligations to people. But he's prohibited from carrying out priestly duties like celebrating Mass and things like that. But I appreciated the article on Crux that he's saying that, you know what, that he's not saying I'm gone, you know, peace out. He says that he sought permission from Pope Francis, and he's waiting. He's waiting on that. He says, I will always, of his fellow priests, he says, I will always be in the pews ready to support you, because my faith in God and love for my church is stronger than ever. I look forward to serving in new ways alongside of you. And so that's something where, you know, there are these two extremes. You know, you one extreme of just, you know, totally throwing away the church, and the other extreme of a rigidity that would try to malign someone like Father Morris, saying like, oh, what a terrible person. It's like, well, I'm sad to see, you're always sad to see a priest leave the priesthood, but if someone does it in a honorable way, respecting the vows that they've made and respecting the law of the church and not telling people, hey, we should just mass exodus from the church. That's something I appreciate, because some of the most vociferous critics of the church, some of the biggest foes I have to deal with in my apologetic work are former Catholics. Some still call themselves Catholics and some no longer anymore, but they have a disdain for the religion they once left.
We have to take a break. We'll be right back with more The Church in the World right after this with Trent Horn.
Your number one source for Catholic apologetics and evangelization, Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their Catholic values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I went to Las Vegas years and years ago for one of these cable shows. And I was shocked to see all these old ladies in their 70s and 80s getting off that plane, running for a slot machine. You don't have a chance to win. They're all fixed. I know, my uncle used to have slot machines.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Catholic Answers Live, Trent Horn, our guest this hour, and we're talking about the church in the world, just kind of making our occasional Friday assessment of the condition, state of things, vis-a-vis the church in the world. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884 if you'd like to talk with Trent or with me. I want to go to Jose in New Jersey now, who's watching on Facebook Live. Jose, you got a question or a comment for Trent?
Hello, how you doing, Trent? I really enjoyed your book, Counterfeit Christ. Honestly, I think I finished it in about a week. I couldn't get my eyes off of it.
Good. Thank you.
Question. Yes, no problem. Question. I have this thing about your last chapter, right? About prudential judgment.
Yes.
Right? So my thing is, in terms of like politics, right? In order for one to adjudicate a policy, doesn't one have to look at morality, right? So here's what I'm saying, is that can a prudential judgment also, in a sense, be objective in policy? I don't know if I'm making sense. I just need clarification on what you mean
like
by prudential
like
judgment.
Can a prudential judgment be morally right or morally wrong? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, because what I'm saying is that, all right, let me set up a scenario. Okay, so I believe in a pro-life stance, right?
Sure.
But in my prudential judgment, I believe that, you know, maybe abortion at maybe 8 weeks, you know, before 8 weeks is okay, right? But I'm still pro-life, you know, like...
Wait. There's a difference here. Okay, so are you talking about the judgment there is nothing wrong with aborting a child at 7 weeks or 6 weeks, or are you talking about, I believe we should pass a law that does abortion at this stage? I didn't catch the difference there.
I'm just saying between policy and the morality. I don't know how to explain it.
Well, yeah, I guess here's what I would say, that a prudential judgment is different than a moral judgment. So according to the Catechism, paragraph 1806, prudence is the virtue that disposes practical reason to discern our true good in every circumstance and to choose the right means of achieving it. So a moral judgment would be a judgment of whether a particular act is right or wrong. So, you know, whether, you know, it's something is morally permissible, whether it's forbidden, whether it's obligatory. A prudential judgment would be a judgment that we make of an act to say, well, does this act achieve the moral goods that we are striving for? So it might be a good or a bad judgment. It might be bad in the sense that it doesn't achieve that good. It may have been done with good intentions, but it doesn't get the job done, actually. So to provide you an example, when the Pilgrims first got here in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, they practiced collective farming because they wanted to achieve the good of making sure that people did not go hungry. So they chose collective farming as a means. That was a prudential judgment they made. Their moral judgment was no one ought to be hungry. That's a correct moral judgment. The problem was they made a bad prudential judgment because collective farming actually led to decreased production of food, and they were actually on the verge of starvation. So what seemed to be the right way to get to a good actually in practice did not. So morality deals with whether something's right or wrong, good or evil. Prudential judgments deal with, well, is this a good or a bad way of achieving this good? And it deals with non-moral issues, usually things like economics, politics, the sciences, to say, well, will this achieve the good that we want or will it lead to unintended consequences? So what my point I was saying in the book was that you should not use the name of Jesus. You should not use Jesus to say, oh, all Christians must choose this prudential judgment when it comes to alleviating poverty, because the church hasn't definitively taught we ought to embrace that judgment. We can disagree with one another. But Jesus, you could use Jesus to say, Jesus tells us you ought to care for the poor. If you don't, you're really in a heap of trouble, to quote Dukes of Hazzard. So is that a helpful explanation, or would you like a little more?
Actually, I think it's helpful. Yeah. But yeah, Trent, I really appreciate the book. Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right.
I would say that was a moderately successful call. He was, it's helpful.
Yeah, works for me. And so I would recommend, if we could go into in-depth. The point is here, like, to do moral, you know, a moral judgment and a prudential judgment. A moral judgment is you ought to help the poor. You can't disagree with that. We ought to help the poor.
Right.
That it's immoral to not do that. Catholics can't disagree about that. But how do we help the poor? What's the best way to help them? There's a myriad of public policies, and the prudential way of trying to achieve that good through policy and through human action, we can reasonably disagree with one another about what is the best way to do that. And so some prudential judgments, they're not relative. Some are good and some are bad. But we're free to disagree with one another to try to arrive at the good ones.
There's a lot more news to get to. We're talking about the church in the world with Trent Horn. Trent is our guest both hours, so he'll be back next hour. So if you're on the line, stay on the line. We'll do our best to get to you. If you haven't called, you're welcome to call 888-31-TRUTH. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and I would like to invite you, please join Radio Club. Just go over to CatholicAnswersLive.com, put in your email address, and then you get free stuff from us. We'll send you free stuff all the time. A whole bunch of cool stuff, behind the scenes stuff, that kind of stuff. Radio Club, join it.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com.